Hello and welcome back. I hope that you have been enjoying this show so far, the series so far, as much as I have. Sister Denise has taken us through the beginning of chapter 2, where we looked at how the conversation ensues between Sri Krishna and Arjuna. And the first part we looked at is the words that God uses to address his friend. So the next question that I have for you, Sister Denise, comes from page 16 of the translation in my possession, where I must admit I struggled to make head or tail of the meaning of this section. It says, it is found that the unreal has no being. It is found that there is no non-being of the real. The certainty of both these propositions is indeed surely seen by the perceivers of truth.
Yes, so it's a deep one.
Yes, please explain it in a way that's more palatable, because I struggled with this.
So just looking at the first part of it, just repeat that first part. It is seen.
It is found that the unreal has no being. So what I understand about that is that inanimate objects do not have a soul.
Of course.
Okay, after that, I get lost. It is found that there is no non-being of the real.
Yes. So it's actually the other side of the coin. Mm. Something that is real persists. Anything that is inanimate is in a constant state of change. What the Brahma Kumari's knowledge says is that the soul changes. What the conventional Gita says is that the soul doesn't change. So there you have a very interesting contrast or difference of angle. So the incorporeal Supreme Father, the Supreme Soul, whom we call Shiva, the benefactor, the seed, and the point, says, I am changeless and I am real. You are real as souls and you change. Objects are real without having consciousness and they change, because anything that is matter is constantly changing, coming into being, persisting for a while, and then falling apart, and then reforming itself as some other object. But the matter itself remains permanent, and it does not have consciousness. So it's a different approach. Very often in conventional interpretations, it will be said that the soul doesn't change, because if it changes, it cannot fit in the criteria of anything real has being. Mm-hmm. So anything unreal doesn't have being, but actually it's not quite like that. God is real, changeless, has being. A human soul, or any soul, but especially a human soul, changes. But it doesn't stop existing as an individual entity. So it's very, very subtle. And from the conventional Gita, you would not get that. So this is one of the very interesting differences that we find in the knowledge given by Shiv Baba through Brahma Baba, the Brahma Kumaris, is that a soul remains intact eternally, immortally, and it changes quality. But it doesn't fall apart and reform itself as something else in the way that matter does. Mm. And matter is one thing. There's a fixed amount of it. it, as Einstein had pointed out, it cannot be created or destroyed, so in that sense is real, but it doesn't have its own consciousness. So there's a different thing.
Sister Denise, thus far, Arjuna has been educated on the inner workings of the self. Okay? So I'm wondering, is the war that he is about to engage in, is he fighting bodies or is he fighting souls?
Well, it's a bit not quite like that. He has to go through the motions of fighting that which cannot be fought.
Okay.
That makes it so difficult.
You have to expand on that answer.
You see, you have to fight what your perceptions are presenting to you by challenging its validity and its veracity, you see. So what Arjuna has to do is deal with his attachment to those souls whom he perceives to be blood relatives, because actually a soul cannot be a blood relative, as the soul didn't have any blood. But the soul in the body becomes part of a family that's connected by blood. And blood is very powerful because it contains this vector, if you will, of attachment. And so the teachings that we receive in Brahma Kumaris says that you need to get beyond the consciousness of the body and attachment to bodily relatives and bodily cultures, because we have a very deep connection to our culture. And so a person's sense of identity comes from their blood relatives and their culture. Whereas the knowledge of the Gita says that that is actually not as real as you think. And if you want to be working with what's really, really real, the most real thing of all is your connection to yourself and your connection to God, incorporeal Supreme God. And then in between you and God, comes your body, your bodily relations, and your bodily culture. Mm-hmm. And so what the Gita is teaching, what God is teaching, is this which is in between you and me, make it go away, destroy it. That's your enemy, fight that, because it's not real. Mm-hmm. So he's not really fighting souls, and he's not really fighting bodies, he's fighting an assumption. The assumption that your identity comes from your culture, it doesn't. You have a bodily identity, you have a bodily cultural identity, but there's a limitation. And I think God's message is get to a point where you're able to transcend these limitations, and the way you do that is to establish yourself in direct communion between the soul, discarnate soul, and the discarnate Supreme Soul. And that connection is called Raj Yoga.
Okay, so then, Sister Denise, this is all brought together on page 18, where it is said, these bodies are inhabited by the eternal, the indestructible, the immeasurable embodied self, are said to come to an end, therefore fight, Arjuna. There's a lot of emphasis on this. So we see that the Supreme Soul is not only telling Arjuna that he should fight, but why he should fight.
Yes.
The knowledge is expanding.
You see, it's difficult for people to reconcile because they're assuming things on a physical level. All the weapons that is shown in the depictions and so on, the assumption that people make is that Krishna is getting Arjuna to kill people. Even though it is said repeatedly that you cannot kill the soul, but when people are body conscious, then killing involves the body. So what it's saying is you have to kill the fact that what you perceive is real, because what you're perceiving isn't real. And the only way that you can actually prove that is by destroying it. But you don't destroy it as a human body or a human object, but you destroy your attachment to it. Because it only has importance to you if you're attached to it. If you're not attached to it, it doesn't matter.
The message or the story of immortality continues in chapter 2, stanza after stanza. We hear about the embodied self is neither born nor does it die at any time. We hear that it's not slain when the body is slain. We hear that it is indestructible, birthless, imperishable. And one gets the sense that God is grinding this in to Arjuna because of his reluctance to learn the lesson. But why? Arjuna represents me and you. Okay? Why don't we want to know this, Sister Denise? Why is there resistance to the truth? We crave it. We get, when you get it, you think, come back tomorrow. why do we do that?
This is the wonder. We want truth, but when we get it, we hate it. We don't like it. Mm. It's not likable. It's not pleasant. Truth is not pleasant. It is disturbing to a person. You see, and
yes, I think you disturbed a lot of people with your answers just now. But the brave ones are still watching you. So
all right.
On. Yes.
No, but the thing is this. Krishna is saying to Arjuna, you must kill, because until you actually do the act of being willing to kill and get past that resistance, you cannot get a visceral experience of the fact that you cannot kill a soul. You see, because what he's doing is he's avoiding killing, which is not much better than killing.
In the sense, how do you get to that conclusion?
Well, if you don't want to kill, it means that you believe that you can kill. Right? And so you don't want to kill because you say, well, if I kill, then this person will die. And he's saying, no, the body will die, but the person won't. And what he's saying is, I don't want to kill the person. So what Krishna's doing is really distinguishing between the body, which is given life by the presence of the person, the soul, and then the soul. If you remove the body from the soul will just reincarnate, get another one. So, I mean, from many angles, the whole business of military activity is pointless, because as soon as you kill somebody, they'll reincarnate anyway. And the very strange thing that we see in war is you get killing and you also get raping together, because the souls who have been summarily taken out of their bodies have to have somewhere to go. So they'll have to reincarnate in the one that you just raped. And the cycle goes on and on and on and on, you see. And that is something too horrible for people to contemplate. But yet the Gita is raising the subject and saying, look, kill means kill your perception that you can kill. And the only way that you can do that is by going through the motions. This is what it's being said all the time, that you cannot get it by just hearing about it. You have to actually act on it. You have to actually do it. Without that, it will not penetrate your consciousness that you are immortal, everybody else is immortal, you see. So this is the barrier that the Gita is trying to get everyone across. It's a very difficult one, because as a body-conscious human being, if you kill someone, it's murder.
Mm.
If you kill yourself, it's suicide. That's also a sin, mm-hmm. you know, and it's very clearly said, murder is a sin, suicide is a sin. And so then here is God himself saying you have to do this because you can't do it. You know, it's so difficult for people to figure it out until you understand that it's that your perception is deceiving you or deluding you. It is not possible to put an end to the existence of a soul. But you cannot get it until you get it by getting a realization. When you get to the end of the Gita, this is really what Arjuna finally gets, is, oh, I understand my attachment, my delusion is broken. But it takes such a long time to get there.
We'll get there. Okay. Right now, we're still evolving to that stage.
Yes.
Okay. So, Sister Denise, having explained the story of immortality to his friend, God then explains to him the aspect of reincarnation and what it entails. Page 22, as after casting away worn-out garments, a man later takes on new ones. So after casting away worn-out bodies, the embodied self encounters other new ones. Before we get to the answer of reincarnation, sometimes self is written in small s and at other times in capital S. And the translator kept this to show he stayed pretty close to the original text. What does capital S mean?
In Sanskrit, there's no capital and small. That only comes in English. So
not Hindi, Sister Denise?
Not Hindi, not Sanskrit. There's no capital and small. There's only one type of letter.
We come back now to the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita and the letter of the Bhagavad Gita. Is it not representing self with respect and self without respect? Self with something, self without something. Is there not a message in this?
This is where it becomes difficult, because it's a matter of interpretation.
Okay.
Where the interpreter, the translator, has to decide whether the self in question is referring to God or a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, again, conceptually you have issues, because in some interpretations, the pure self, the higher self, is indistinguishable from God. In Brahma Kumari's teachings, it's always very clear which self is the Supreme Being and which self is you. Whereas, because the self, human self, changes from pure to impure over the period of reincarnations, you have a pure self and an impure self. And so the process of changing from the impure self to the pure self is often interpreted as the process whereby the soul becomes God, but it's not. As we understand in Brahma Kumaris, the soul can never become God, but the soul can become the pure form of itself, and through the process of reincarnation becomes the ordinary form. And so because of existing concepts, the interpretations are put like that. But according to the understanding that we are given in Brahma Kumaris, it isn't exactly like that.
Explain reincarnation as is described on page 22 to us. the soul casts away worn-out bodies and the embodied self encounters other new ones.
Well, normally speaking, you will hope to die of old age because your body no longer will serve you, and so you leave it, and then you will go into a womb, spend some time in that womb while your body is reaching a stage that is mature enough to take birth as a baby, and then the soul will grow up and pass through childhood, youth, maturity, and again become old, and then again leave the body and start again as an infant. That is the process. Now, there is also the possibility of untimely death. And so when you're on the battlefield, generally speaking, the soldiers are young, and so they will be killed at an early age, and they are very traumatically cast out of one body and then into another body. And so this is where you have the impact of trauma mixed into other aspects of karma, which makes the whole issue of battle and war such a terrible thing, because so many people are killed. Mm. You know, in the Second World War, 67 million people were killed. That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And all traumatically.
Yes.
And so this aspect of violence makes death abnormal from normal. And there's an impact on the soul, a big impact on the soul. And so where Krishna is saying to Arjuna, you have to do this abnormal thing. So obviously he's going to be very hesitant. So God is telling him, look, if somebody dies of old age, or if they die of any other thing, whether it's a timely moment or an untimely moment, it's still the same thing. The soul cannot be killed, and the body can. But then there's a big impact in terms of the karma and the psychology of the person.
Mm. Sister Denise, page 28 struck me because the wording that's used is pretty interesting, thought-provoking. Beings are such that their beginnings are unmanifest, their middles are manifest, and their ends are unmanifest again. What complaint can there be over this? Before we get to the complaint part, how do you understand unmanifest and manifest?
What we learn in Brahma Kumaris is this, which I think is not generally known. That is that the soul retains its identity, whether in a body or not. So there is a period of time, which you can call the beginning, where a soul is in what we call the realm of souls, which is a very different dimension from the material world that we live in, the planet Earth, the universe, and all that. So there is a world which is also known as Nirvana, all known as the soul world, we call it the soul world, where souls are like seeds. And then when their time comes, they come onto the earth and they begin their course of reincarnations. And some souls are more time, some souls are less time, it's all very individual. But when a soul has completed the course of reincarnations, they return to that which is described as unmanifest. So you're manifest when you're in a body, and whatever are the sanskaras contained in the soul, that is expressed through the body. And so in order for a person to understand themselves fully and completely, you have to be able to consider yourself to be a soul who isn't manifest through a body, but who still exists in the seed form. So in the seed form, you're not doing anything, but you do exist individually. like without, any seed.
Without a body.
Without a body, yes.
Okay.
So God is also without a body, but it's different. Because as a human soul without a body is merged, unmanifest, you can say. God can remain aware without having a body.
Mm.
Whereas human soul becomes like asleep, completely like a seed, non-active. Not even, so nirvana means the world without sound, not even the sound of a thought. So when a soul is thinking, is active, is manifest, and in order to be thinking, you need a brain. You have to have a body. So you go from body to body to body to body until you've completed your cycle of reincarnations. Then you return for some unspecified time to the unmanifest state. This is how we understand it.
Hmm. Page 29 grabbed my attention because you addressed it earlier. Someone perceives this as a wonder. Another declares this as a wonder. Still another hears of this as a wonder. But even having heard of this, no one knows it. So, what is it that caused this mega block? And the reason I'm asking this question, Sister Denise, is this scripture has been in existence for thousands of years. There are millions of people across the globe who read it daily. Okay. However, the reality speaks for itself.
You know, every person has a mind, has a power of intelligence, has their individuality, but everyone is very different. So if I'm reading a scripture and interpreting it the way I do, it's unlikely to be the same as another person. It seems to me that what the Gita is saying here is that there are some souls who are naturally able to apprehend God.
Oh, that is a beautiful expression, apprehend God.
Then there's other souls.
Oh, does that mean to hold God in your mind?
Yeah, you can perceive God. You can commune with God. These are the mystics. There's not very many of them. And they are found in all the different religions, you know. And they're different. They're not regular people. There's something extraordinary. It's a phenomenon. That's why it's called a wonder. Then there's a lot of other people who, you know, they appreciate the poetry.
Mm.
You know, and they kind of get a feel for it, but they can't get it. And then there's others who say, yeah, there are some people who talk about it, but we don't know what it is. I do, however, differ with the conventional Gita in that I do believe that those few souls who are able to apprehend God and who are able to commune with God and communicate with God, they can know God, but it's very few. I think a lot of people aspire to be that, but in many ways, you know, if you think about it, you don't know who you are. It's only once you start to have yoga, which means you start the process of communing with God, making connection, then you start to fill with the qualities of God. It's only then that you begin to realize whether you're a high capacity soul or middle capacity soul or low capacity soul or whatever. And I think really the high capacity souls may be unexpected or maybe discover themselves that, oh my goodness, maybe I'm a high capacity soul, let's see how far I can take this, and actually are able to go so close to God that they would be in that category. But it's so unspoken. I think that somebody who's doing that's not going to tell anybody because it's so private, you know. And I think that a soul of that caliber is capable of founding a religion. You know, there's very, very few people like that, but there's a lot of people who get that there is such a thing, and who see people, you know, going in that direction or being connected, and they appreciate it and they recognize that it is there, but they themselves can't go there. So this is really what the Gita is saying, is that people are really, they're all spiritual beings, but they're very different. And there's a hierarchy actually of souls. And when souls are depleted, this is also something that we are very aware about in Brahma Kumaris, when everybody's depleted, everyone looks equally kind of empty, spiritually empty. But it's once you start to fill through meditation with the energy of God, the qualities of God, that you start to feel the differentiation. Because a low caliber soul, you can say, can't fill very high. It's sort of like batteries. You can recharge a battery only up to the capacity of that battery. But if it's a high capacity battery, it'll just keep on taking charge until it reaches its limit. And so this is really how we can sort of appreciate the differences in the souls.
Hmm. Okay, Sister Denise, we'll pause there for now. Thank you, and thank you very much. So there you have it. Sister Denise has shared what is meant in the first few stanzas of chapter 2 in the Bhagavad Gita. She has shared what is meant by the story of immortality. Sister Denise has shared what reincarnation is, what it means to take on another body, what it means to understand one is a soul. And also, once the soul has received this understanding, what we do with it. Some accept it and change, and others don't. And Sister Denise had made no illusion about the fact that this is difficult to comprehend and even more difficult to become. So I hope that you are able to grasp the full extent of what Sister Denise was sharing. And I also hope to see you for our next episode. Thank you so much for joining us, and goodbye.